This episode is brought to you by Progressive, home of the Name Your Price tool. You say how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. It's easy to start a quote. Visit progressive.com to get started. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. Hello and welcome to This Day in Esoteric Political History from Radiotopia. My name is Jody Avergan. This day, January 12, 1943, the U.S. government announces that as a, quote, wartime necessity, it would limit the amount and quality of meat products sent to stores around the country. To support the troops abroad, the government argued Americans would have to limit their consumption of meat at home. This effort would come to include some rationing, 2.5 pounds of meat per week for every adult, 1.5 pounds of meat for kids. It also came with some good old American spin. These new meat products came to be known as victory sausages. Maybe it's just me, Nicole, but that's not the most intimidating phrase, victory sausages, but that's what we got in 1943.
I wouldn't call it intimidating. I wouldn't necessarily call it inspiring either.
You don't think there was a rally around the sausage effect?
Well, we'll have to stay tuned to see.
Yeah, exactly. That, of course, is Nicole Hemmer of Columbia. Nikki, hello. Welcome.
Hello, Jody.
So let me just read you a quote here from Charles M. Elkington, who's an official at the Meats Division of the Office of Price Administration, who I guess was the person who announced this move. He said that all cold cuts would soon be replaced by a standard ersatz product. The new victory sausage would consist of some meat and an unspecified amount of substitutes. So they were watering down or soybeaning down the meat, as we will discuss.
Sawdusting it down.
And then Elkington says, quote, there is no escape from it. The federal government will have to make and enforce an arbitrary sausage formula. So if you go to meat school, this is what you train for. Right. This is your five alarm meat fire, Elkington. This was his moment. But look, we shouldn't joke here. This is serious. Right. This is part of a larger rationing campaign during World War II. And it's a pretty big deal to say meat in America is no longer meat as we know it.
Yes. I mean, we should joke about it a little bit.
Yeah. OK.
The Meats Division of the Office of Price Administration is an amazing job title, one that I look forward to holding sometime in the future. Mm-hmm. And it
dream big
seem,
dreams. Dream
right?
big dreams.
Yeah. It does seem like Americans were eating a lot of meat.
I know.
Right. 2.5 pounds for an adult, 1.5 pounds for kids. And that's like the rationed amount.
Exactly.
But it was in response to something pretty important, as you were saying, which is that Americans had to restrict what they consumed during the war. And unlike during World War I, where those restrictions were voluntary, we talked about things like meatless Mondays and wheatless Wednesdays, these days when you would have this social pressure not to indulge in these products so that you could save them for the war. In World War II, people actually had ration coupons, and if they wanted more than their allotted amount of meat, they were going to have to go on the black market. Which was actually pretty robust for meat because people want it more than their 2.5 pounds.
I want to get into some of the details of this specifically because there are some really interesting wrinkles. But I do want to also ask you, I think, a pretty naive question, which is this. Like, we often think of World War II, or I think of World War II, as sort of an economic driver that got us out of the Depression. So I'm trying to hold that idea in my head at the same time that I'm holding an idea of rationing and other efforts, as we've discussed and as we're seeing here, that seem really linked to kind of economic hard times.
Yeah, you're exactly right that it was a time of both lots of economic production and lots of economic restriction. And the reason why is because all of the things that were being produced were going to the war effort.
Yeah.
So even though the factories were all spun up, they weren't making cars or pantyhose or producing meat for your dinner table. They were putting all of that stuff into the war effort. So it is true that the economy, in a sense, especially the production part of the economy, was booming. And in fact, people's wages were going up and they were making more money. So their savings were growing. But there wasn't a ton that they could spend it on because of the wartime restrictions. So it's a very unusual kind of economy. And you can imagine for people who had had to go without for so long during the Depression to be in this economic boom time and still not be able to have all of the goods that society was now producing. must have just seemed like 15 years of real hardship.
Yeah, yeah. There are, of course, winners and losers in every story. It seems to me that one winner, if you want to call it that here, are soybean manufacturers in the United States, because what starts to happen is, you know, this part of the policy here is we're going to reduce the amount of meat in sausages and other meat goods that get sent out to stores, and we're going to supplement that. Were you joking about the sawdust thing, or was that actually the going on? Because what I read was mostly just replacing it with a soy product.
I was sort of joking, which is to say that when you're in the realm of meat fillers, you get into a pretty dicey area.
Yeah. It's not a realm I try and kind of traffic in too often.
Because soy certainly is a type of meat filler, but there were all kinds of meat fillers that were used in an era of, let's call it, looser regulation. I think the thing that was really sticking in my mind, if we go back to an earlier war, the Spanish-American War, there was a bunch of meat from the U.S. being sent to soldiers in Cuba, and that meat tended to be corrupted, chemically altered, or spoiled, and it led to this big crisis called the embalmed meat crisis. And that, along with Upton Sinclair's The Jungle, which portrayed the making of meat in the meatpacking district and had these very vivid passages of things like rats and rusty nails and scraps and even people being ground up together to make all of these meat products, made people pretty wary of both meatpacking and meat fillers. I mean, even at the time, they called this victory meat extenders, which is, again, pretty gross. And I don't think it's the best use of the label victory.
Yeah. So extenders meaning like a way to make the meat last longer. So extend that it with a little bit of filler.
Yeah.
It's so funny. The story has
appetizing.
Like good. Yeah. This is a story. And I guess the Mad Men era had not come along just yet to say like branding matters. Maybe victory meat extender isn't the best way.
We need to get the ad guys name. On this one.
Exactly, exactly. We should do an episode about The Jungle at some point, because in addition
to grossing
people out, it was, I think it was one of the big things that led to a lot of reforms in a lot of industries in this country. But back to our victory sausages here. They start to brand them victory sausages. Obviously, that's not just because it's a new product and you want to call it something different, but obviously there's like a rallying effect here. There's a branding effect here. And this does lead to some spats and people. we actually can't tell whether this was a parody or not, but we did find an article in which someone kind of was railing against the canceling of the hot dog as part of this effort.
Look, cancel culture has been going on for a long time, Jody, and people have been writing letters to the New York Times since at least 1943. Yeah, I mean, people don't like when you mess with their food, and you can understand the rebranding effort necessary because, look, you're giving people subpar products and you're not making those yummy sausages that they were able to get a few years earlier available. And so this is in part a rebranding like that, but it is also because a lot of the names for various sausages were things like Frankfurter and other German derived names that when you're at war with Nazi Germany causes people to bristle a little.
Yeah. And in researching this, you know, I've come to realize, I'm not being facetious here, but, you know, a lot of like quintessentially American foods do seem to have Germanic roots. I mean, there's sauerkraut, and not a surprise, right? And so many German immigrants come to this country and settle in the Midwest. And so I would imagine that, yeah, exactly what you were saying. Like, we go to war, and I guess this happened in World War I as well, where there was a lot of anti-German sentiment. And then again in World War II, and you're looking down at your food and it has a Germanic vibe to it. Maybe it does feel patriotic to call it something else.
Yeah, this is so important. So German immigrants to the U.S. were the biggest immigrant group in the early and mid-19th century. So by the time you get to the 20th century, they represent the largest immigrant group or the largest ethnic group in the United States. And so these foods that we think of quintessentially American, like hot dogs and hamburgers, are fundamentally German foods, but just have a twist on the name. And then you get that very ugly anti-German sentiment and anti-German racism during the First World War. And it leads, you know, people to stop speaking the German language at home. It leads them to begin to rename all of these different foods. So sauerkraut becomes Liberty cabbage, and hamburgers become Liberty sandwiches. And it's all pretty silly and kind of stupid.
I mean, there was actually a bill in Congress to do exactly what you just said. You're not kind of riffing there. You're actually reading from attempts to formally change sauerkraut to Liberty. I believe the Dachshunds, the dogs, were supposed to be Liberty pups. I mean, this is really going on.
Yeah, it really was. And remember when Congress in the early 2000s changed French fries to freedom fries? It's the same kind of jingoistic impulse that had real consequences for German immigrants in the United States. My family was one that came up in one of those small German communities in southern Indiana. And it really meant that you changed the language that you spoke. You changed how you presented yourself in public because you were pretty concerned about what the backlash was going to look like.
There's also reports of during the First World War and between the wars, a lot of German families changed their last names and Anglicanized their last names. Is Hemmer, do you know the story of Hemmer?
Hemmer is straight German. So, yeah, our families came over in the 1870s. And my mom's last name was Bittner. So these were very, very strong directly from Bavaria names.
Yeah. A couple other of these tidbits here. I mean, there's even reports that people suffering from German measles, newspapers would start to refer to it as Liberty measles, which seems like all sorts
feels
of
like
twisted
you would wanna,
logic
yeah.
going on there. Yeah, you would want to call
you
it.
You want to keep.
Right. We talked about how the Spanish flu was called the Spanish flu because of these jingoistic efforts or whatever. But nope, Liberty measles. People stopped listening to Bach and Beethoven and Brahms because of anti-German sentiment.
People get weird in wartime, Jody.
And it does kind of fit into a larger, I don't know if you want to call it a legacy, or at least certainly, you know, other moments where the naming of things have changed for political reasons. And we started to kind of have a little fun researching some of these. Any favorites that you found that you want to bring up?
Yeah, I mean, the one that really sticks out to me, especially because we are in a renaming period in our own time, is that the Cincinnati Reds during the Red Scare suddenly had a name that was associated with many Americans' biggest fears, this fear of communism coming into the United States, and they didn't want to be associated with that. So they renamed themselves briefly the Cincinnati Redlegs, which I'm not sure does it, but there you go.
Yeah. And the one that I found, and honestly, I'm flabbergasted by, is that there is a town in Ontario called Swastika, Ontario.
Thanks.
And there was an attempt briefly during the rise of Hitler to change the name, and the town, I think, briefly maybe changed it, but then changed it back. And this is, of course, a reminder that the swastika is a Sanskrit good luck symbol, and it was appropriated by Nazi Germany. But nevertheless, I just feel like if your town is named Swastika, you got to change that name. I can't believe it's still there.
Yeah, like, I'm all for reclaiming language, but in this case, you're going to be misunderstood more than you're going to be understood.
Yeah. Okay, let's bring it back to Victory Sausages and talk a little bit about the legacy. I mean, you kind of mentioned it, sort of stating the obvious here, but like, this is another moment in which war, these big galvanizing events change everything, right? And so it's Victory Sausages, but then we also start to see, you know, it's the rise of the soybean industry, but we also really see like American diets getting reshaped as a part of this. I mean, there are some really big tectonic shifts going on because that's kind of what happens. We're living through a moment like it now, I think, you know, that's what happens during these big moments of crisis. Everything shifts and you kind of don't even know, but there's going to be ripple effects for decades and decades and decades.
Yeah, I mean, not only were Americans in the 1940s winning the war against the Nazis, but they were winning it against heart disease thanks to these restrictions, because you were eating less red meat, you were eating more chicken, you were eating less sugar, more fresh fruits and vegetables. All of a sudden, Americans were eating pretty healthy diets because they weren't able to get a hold of many of their vices. Now, I will say that changes pretty quickly as soon as the war is over. But for this brief moment, you get this experiment of what it might look like if it wasn't all meat and potatoes.
Yeah, I think the meat and sugar and starch lobby kind of really starts to...
They come roaring back.
They come roaring back in the 60s and 70s and 80s. All right, I think we've covered it. So yeah, that brings us to the end of the episode. And sorry, I should have asked you earlier. Are you passionate about how you dress a sausage? How do you eat your hot dog or your sausage?
Look, I'm a purist. I don't get to have hot dogs very often, but when I do, I want it in a white bread bun with a squeeze of ketchup right down the middle and don't put anything else on it.
That's it? Just ketchup?
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay. I don't really have an opinion. I actually did not grow up eating red meat and never found hot dogs. I think
it's all
still
or no meat for you.
I still think there's some extender in those hot dogs is my suspicion, so I tend to stay away. All right.
Now that we've added our own filler.
Exactly. All right, Nicole Hemmer, thanks to you as always.
Thank you, Jody.
This Day in Esoteric Political History is a proud member of Radiotopia from PRX, a network of independent, listener-supported, artist-owned podcasts. If you would like to support this podcast, certainly spread the word, leave a rating or a review. You can also support us directly if you want. You can give monthly, you can give a one-time donation. It is a big part of the puzzle for us to make this show. You can find all that information at thisdaypod.com. That is also where you can find links to transcripts of the show. You can get in touch with us with any questions or comments or opinions about the best way to eat a hot dog. Find it all, thisdaypod.com, or send us an email, thisdaypod@gmail.com. Our researcher and producer is Jacob Feldman. Our producer is Brittany Brown. Kala Nakua helps with our transcripts. My name is Jody Avergan. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you soon.
With most meat going to feed the biggest army in U.S. history, a series of Meatless Tuesdays went into effect. Housewives were urged to save fats for the war effort. They got their reward in extra meat points, and they were also paid 4 cents a pound. After we get rid of the ration book, America was back on wheels, and rationing was only a memory.
Radiotopia.